After a brief hesitation, she slid her hand to her eyes. She traced their contours with her fingertips, and what she discovered caused her hand to tremble. Abruptly, she remembered not only how she had wound up in this place, but everything else, her life back to childhood, all in a flash, far more than she wanted to remember, more than she could bear. She snatched her hand away from her eyes and made a thin, awful sound of grief. She felt crushed under the weight of memory. Margaret returned, shoes squeaking softly. The glass clinked against the nightstand when she put it down. "I'll just raise the bed so you'll be able to drink." The motor hummed and the head of the bed began to lift, forcing Jennifer into a sitting position.
"Does he still come?"
Jennifer asked shakily.
"Of course he does. At least twice a week. You were even alert on one of his visits a few days ago. Don't you remember?"
Jennifer's heart was racing. A pressure swelled across her chest. Her throat was so tight with fear that she had trouble speaking.
I don't.
"What's the matter, Jenny?"
"Don't want him here."
"Oh, no, you don't mean that."
"Keep him out of here."
"He's so devoted."
"No. He's...
"At least twice a week, and he sits with you for a couple of hours, whether you're with us or wrapped up inside yourself."
Jennifer shuddered at the thought of him in the room by the bed when she was not aware of her surroundings. She reached out blindly, found Margaret's arm, squeezed it as tightly as she could.
"He's not like you or me,"
she said urgently. "Jenny, you're upsetting yourself."
"He's different."
Margaret put her hand on Jennifer's, gave it a reassuring squeeze.
"Now, I want you to stop this, Jenny."
"He's inhuman."
"You don't mean that. You don't know what you're saying."
"He's a monster."
"Poor baby. Relax, honey."
A hand touched Jennifer's forehead, began to smooth away the furrows, brushed the hair back.
"Don't get yourself excited. Everything will be all right. You're going to be fine, baby. Just settle down easy now. Relax. You're safe here. We love you here. We'll take good care of you."
After more of that, Jennifer grew calmer, but no less afraid. The aroma of oranges made her mouth water. While Margaret held the glass, Jennifer drank through a straw. Her mouth didn't work quite right. Occasionally she had minor difficulty swallowing, but the juice was cold and delicious. When she emptied the glass, she let the nurse blot her mouth with a paper napkin. She listened to the soothing fall of the rain, hoping that it would settle her nerves. It did not.
"Should I turn the radio on?" Margaret asked.
"No, thank you."
"I could read to you if you'd like. Poetry. You always enjoy listening to poetry."
"That would be nice."
Margaret drew a chair to the side of the bed and sat in it. As she sought a certain passage in the book, the turning of the pages was a crisp and pleasant sound.
"Margaret,"
Jennifer said before the woman could begin to read.
"Yes?"
"When he comes to visit..."
"What is it, dear?"
"You'll stay in the room with us, won't you?"
"If that's what you want, of course."
"Good.
Now, how about a little Emily Dickinson?"
"Margaret?"
"Hmm?"
"When he comes to visit, and I'm lost inside myself, you never let me alone with him, do you?"
Margaret was silent, and Jennifer could almost see the woman's disapproving frown.
"Do you?"
she insisted.
"No, dear. I never do."
Jennifer knew the nurse was lying.
"Please, Margaret. You seem like a kind person. Please."
"Dear, really, he loves you. He comes so faithfully because he loves you. You're in no danger from your Brian. None at all."
She shivered at the mention of the name.
"I know you think I'm mentally disturbed. Confused."
"A little Emily Dickinson will help."
"I am confused about a lot of things,"
Jennifer said, dismayed to hear her voice growing rapidly weaker.
But not this. I'm not the least bit confused about this.
In a voice too full of artifice to convey the powerful, hidden sinewiness of Dickinson, the nurse began to read. That love is all there is all we know of love. Half of the large table in Ricky Estefan's spacious kitchen was covered with a drop cloth on which were arranged the small-scale power tools he used to craft silver jewelry. A handheld drill, engraving instrument, emery wheel, buffer, and less easily identifiable equipment. Bottles of fluids and cans of mysterious compounds were neatly arranged to one side, as were small paintbrushes, white cotton cloths, and steel wool pads. He had been at work on two pieces when Harry interrupted, a strikingly detailed scarab brooch and a massive belt buckle covered with Indian symbols, maybe Navajo or Hopi, his second career. His forge and mold-making equipment were in the garage, but when he worked on the finishing details of his jewelry, he sometimes liked to sit by the kitchen window where he could enjoy a view of his rose garden. Outside, even in the dreary gray deluge, the plentiful blooms were radiant, yellow and red and coral, some as big as grapefruits. Harry sat at the uncluttered part of the table with his coffee while Ricky shuffled to the other side and put his cup and saucer down among the cans, bottles, and tools. He lowered himself into his chair as stiffly as an octogenarian with severe arthritis. 3 years ago, Ricky Estefan had been a cop, one of the best, Harry's partner. He'd been a good-looking guy, too, with a full head of hair, not yellow-white as it was now, but thick and black. His life had changed when he had unwittingly walked into the middle of a robbery at a convenience store. The strung-out gunman had a crack habit for which he needed financing, and maybe he smelled cop the moment Ricky stepped through the door, or maybe he was in the mood to waste anyone who even inadvertently delayed the transfer of the money from the cash register to his pockets. Whichever the case, he fired 4 times at Ricky, missing him once, hitting him once in the left thigh and twice in the abdomen. "How's the jewelry business?" Harry asked. "Pretty good. I sell everything I make, get more orders for custom belt buckles than I can fill." Ricky sipped his coffee and savored it before swallowing. Coffee was not on his approved diet. If he drank too much, it played hell with his stomach, or what was left of his stomach. Getting gut shot is easy. Surviving is a bitch. He was lucky that the perp's weapon was only a .22 pistol, unlucky that it was fired at close range. For beginners, Ricky had lost his spleen, part of his liver, and a small section of his large intestine. Although his surgeons took every precaution to keep the abdominal cavity clean, the slugs spread fecal matter, and Ricky quickly developed acute, diffuse traumatic peritonitis. Barely survived it. Gas gangrene set in, antibiotics wouldn't stop it, and he underwent additional surgery in which he lost his gallbladder and a portion of his stomach, then a blood infection. Temperature somewhere near that on the sunward surface of Mercury. Peritonitis again, too, and the removal of another piece of the colon. Through it all, he had maintained an amazingly upbeat mood, and in the end felt blessed that he had retained enough of his gastrointestinal system to be spared the indignity of having to wear a colostomy bag for the rest of his life. He'd been off duty when he'd walked into that store armed but expecting no trouble. He had promised Anita, his wife, to pick up a quart of milk and a tub of soft margarine on his way home from work. The gunman had never come to trial. The distraction provided by Ricky had allowed the store owner, Mr. Wo Tai Han, to pick up a shotgun that he kept behind the counter. He'd taken off the back of the perp's head with a blast from that 12-gauge. Of course, this being the last decade of the millennium, that had not been the end of it. The mother and father of the gunman sued Mr. Han for depriving them of the affection, companionship, and financial support of their deceased son, and never mind that a crack addict was incapable of providing any of those things. Harry drank some coffee. It was good and strong. "You hear from Mr. Han lately?" "Yeah, he's really confident about winning on appeal." Harry shook his head. "Never can tell what a jury will do these days." Ricky smiled tightly. "Yeah, I figure I'm lucky I didn't get sued, too." He hadn't been lucky in much else. At the time of the shooting, he and Anita had been married only 8 months.
She stayed with him another year until he was on his feet, but when she realized he was going to be an old man for the rest of his days, she called it quits. She was 26. She had a life to live. Besides, these days, the clause of the matrimony vows that mentioned in sickness and in health till death do us part was widely regarded as not binding until the end of a lengthy trial period of, say, a decade. Sort of like not being vested in a pension plan until you had worked for the company for 5 years. For the past 2 years, Ricky had been alone. It must be Kenny G Day. Another of his tunes was on the radio. This one was less melodic than the first. It made Harry edgy. Maybe any song would have made him edgy just then. "What's wrong?" Ricky asked. "How'd you know something's wrong?" "You'd never in a million years go visiting friends for no reason during work hours. You always give the taxpayer his money's worth." "Am I really that rigid? Do you really need to ask?" "That must have been a pain in the ass to work with." Sometimes, Ricky smiled. Harry told him about James Ordegard and the death among the mannequins. Ricky listened. He spoke hardly at all, but when he did have something to say, it was always the right thing. He knew how to be a friend. When Harry stopped and stared for a long while at the roses in the rain, apparently finished, Ricky said, "That's not everything." "No," Harry admitted. He fetched the coffee pot, refreshed their cups, sat down again. "There was this hobo." Ricky listened to that part of it as soberly as he had listened to the rest. He did not seem incredulous. No slightest doubt was visible in his eyes or attitude. After he had heard it all, he said, "So what do you make of it?" "Could have been seeing things, hallucinating." "Could you? You?" "But for God's sake, Ricky, how could it have been real? Is the hobo really weirder than the perp in the restaurant?" The kitchen was warm, but Harry was chilled. He folded both hands around the hot coffee cup. "Yeah, he's weirder. Not by much, maybe, but worse. The thing is, you think maybe I should request psychiatric leave, take a couple of weeks for counseling?" "Since when did you start believing those brain flushers know what they're doing?" "I don't, but I wouldn't be happy about some other cop walking around with a loaded gun hallucinating." "You're no danger to anyone but yourself, Harry. You're going to worry yourself to death sooner or later. Look, as for this guy with red eyes, everybody has something happen to him sometime in his life that he can't explain, a brush with the unknown." "Not me," Harry said firmly, shaking his head. "Even you. Now, if this guy starts driving up in a whirlwind every hour on the hour, asking if he could have a date, wants to tongue kiss you, then maybe you have a problem." Armies of rain marched across the bungalow roof. "I'm a tightly wound customer," Harry said. "I realize it."
"Exactly. You're tight. Not a loose bolt in you, my man."
He and Ricky watched the rain for a couple of minutes, saying nothing. Finally, Ricky put on a pair of protective goggles and picked up the silver belt buckle. He switched on the handheld buffer, which was about the size of an electric toothbrush and not loud enough to hinder conversation, and began cleaning tarnish and minute silver shavings out of one of the etched designs. After a while, Harry sighed.
"Thanks, Ricky."
"Sure."
Harry took his cup and saucer to the sink, rinsed them off, and put them in the dishwasher. On the radio, Harry Connick Jr. was singing about love. Over the sink was another window. The hard rain was beating the hell out of the roses. Bright petals like confetti were scattered across the soaked lawn. When Harry returned to the table, Ricky turned off the buffer and started to get up. Harry said,
"It's okay, I'll let myself out."
Ricky nodded. He looked so frail.
"I'll see you soon."
"Won't be too long till the season starts,"
Ricky said.
"Let's take in an Angels game opening week."
"I like that," Ricky said.
They both enjoyed baseball. There was a comforting logic in the structure and progression of every game. It was an antidote for daily life. On the front porch, Harry slipped into his shoes again and tied the laces while the lizard that he had frightened upon arrival, or one just like it, watched him from the arm of the nearest chair. Slightly iridescent green and purple scales glimmered dully along each serpentine curve of its body as if a handful of semi-precious stones had been discarded there on the white wood. He felt back in balance again, calm. As he came off the last step onto the sidewalk and into the rain, Harry looked toward the car and saw someone sitting in the front passenger seat. A shadowy, hulking figure, wild hair and a tangled beard. The intruder was facing away from Harry, but then he turned his head. Even through the rain-spotted side window and from a distance of 30 feet, the hobo was instantly recognizable. Harry swung back toward the house, intending to shout for Ricky Estefan, but changed his mind when he recalled how suddenly the vagrant had vanished before. He looked at the car, expecting to discover that the apparition had evaporated, but the intruder was still there. In his bulky black raincoat, the man seemed too large for the sedan, as if he were not in a real car, but in one of those scaled-down versions in a bumper car pavilion at a carnival. Harry moved quickly along the front walk, slopping through gray puddles. Drawing nearer to the street, he saw the well-remembered scars on the maniacal face and the red eyes. As he reached the car, Harry said, "What are you doing in there?" Even through the closed window, the hobo's reply was clearly audible. Tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock. "Get out of here," Harry ordered. Tick, tock, tick, tock. An indefinable but unnerving quality of the derelict's grin made Harry hesitate. Tick, tock. Harry drew his revolver, held it with a muzzle skyward. He put his left hand on the door handle. Tick, tock. Those liquid red eyes daunted Harry. They looked like blood blisters that might burst and stream down the grizzled face. The sight of them, so inhuman, was enervating. Before his courage could drain away, he jerked open the door. He was almost knocked over by a blast of cold wind and staggered backward 2 steps. It came out of the sedan as if an Arctic gale had been stored up in there, stung his eyes, and drew forth tears. The wind passed in a couple of seconds. Beyond the open car door, the front passenger seat was empty. Harry could see enough of the sedan interior to know for certain that the vagrant was not in there anywhere. Nevertheless, he circled the vehicle, looking through all of the windows. He stopped at the back of the car, fished his keys out of his pocket, and unlocked the trunk, covering it with his revolver as the lid swung up. Nothing. Spare tire, jack, lug wrench, and tool pouch. Surveying the quiet residential neighborhood, Harry slowly became aware of the rain again, of which he'd been briefly oblivious. A vertical river poured out of the sky. He was soaked to the skin. He slammed the trunk lid and then the front passenger door. He went around to the driver's side and got in behind the steering wheel. His clothes made wet, squishing noises as he sat down. Earlier, on the street in downtown Laguna Beach, the hobo had reeked of body odor and had expelled searingly bad breath, but there was no lingering stink of him in the car. Harry locked the doors. Then he returned his revolver to the shoulder holster under his sodden sport coat. He was shivering. Driving away from Enrique Estefan's bungalow, Harry switched on the heater, turned it up high. Water seeped out of his soaked hair and trickled down the nape of his neck. His shoes were swelling and tightening around his feet. He remembered the softly radiant eyes staring at him through the car window, the oozing sores in the scarred and filthy face, the crescent of broken yellow teeth, and abruptly he was able to identify the unnerving quality in the hobo's grin which had halted him as he had first been about to yank open the door. Gibbering lunacy was not what made the strange derelict so threatening. It was not the grin of a madman. It was the grin of a predator. Cruising shark, stalking panther, wolf prowling by moonlight, something far more formidable and deadly than a mere deranged vagrant. All the way back to special projects in Laguna Niguel, the scenery and the streets were familiar, nothing mysterious about the other motorists that he passed, nothing otherworldly about the play of headlights and the nickel-bright rain or the metallic clicking that the cold droplets made against the skin of the sedan. Nothing eerie about the silhouettes of palm trees against the iron sky. Yet he was overcome by a feeling of the uncanny, and he struggled to avoid the conclusion that he had brushed up against something supernatural. Tick-tock! Tick-tock! He thought about the rest of what the hobo had said after appearing out of the whirlwind. "You'll be dead by dawn!" He glanced at his watch. The crystal was still filmed with rainwater, the face distorted, but he could read the time. 3:28. When was sunrise? 6:00? 6:30? Thereabouts, somewhere between. At most 15 hours away. The metronomic thump of the windshield wipers began to sound like the ominous cadence of funeral drums. This was ridiculous. The derelict couldn't have followed him all the way to Enrique's house from Laguna Beach, which meant the hobo was not real, merely imagined, and therefore posed no threat. He was not relieved. If the hobo was imaginary, Harry was in no danger of dying by dawn. But as far as he could see, that left a single alternative explanation, and not one that was reassuring. He must be having a nervous breakdown. Harry's side of the office was comforting. The blotter and pen set were perfectly squared with each other and precisely aligned with the edges of the desk. The brass clock showed the same time as did his wristwatch. The leaves of the potted palm, Chinese evergreens, and the pothos were all clean and glossy. The blue screen of the computer monitor was soothing as well, and all the special projects forms were installed as macros, so he could complete them and print them without resort to a typewriter. Uneven spacing inevitably resulted when one attempted to fill in the blanks on forms with that antiquated technology. He was an excellent typist, and he could compose case narrative in his head almost as fast as he could type. Anyone was capable of filling in blank spaces or making X's and boxes, but not everyone was skilled at the part of the job he liked to call the essay test. His case narratives were written in language both more vivid and succinct than of any other detective he had ever known. As his fingers flew across the keyboard, crisp sentences formed on the screen, and Harry Lyon was more at peace with the world than he had been at any time since he had sat at his breakfast table that morning, eating English muffins with lemon marmalade and enjoying the view of the meticulously trimmed condominium greenbelt. When James Ordegard's killing spree was summarized in spare prose stripped of value-weighted verbs and adjectives, the episode didn't seem half as bizarre as when Harry actually had been a part of it. He hammered out the words, and the words soothed. He was even feeling sufficiently relaxed to allow himself to get more casual in the office than was his habit. He unbuttoned the collar of his shirt and slightly loosened the knot of his tie. He took a break from the paperwork only to walk down the hall to the vending machine room to get a cup of coffee. His clothes were still damp in spots and hopelessly wrinkled, but the frost in his marrow had melted. On his way back to the office with the coffee, he saw the hobo. The hulking vagrant was at the far end of the hall, crossing the intersection, passing left to right in another corridor. Facing forward, never looking toward Harry, the guy moved purposefully, as if in the building on other business. In a few long strides, he was through the intersection and out of sight. As Harry hurried along the hall to see where the man had gone, trying not to spill the coffee, he told himself that it hadn't been the same person. There had been a vague resemblance, that was all. Imagination and frayed nerves had done the rest. His denials were without conviction. The figure at the end of the corridor had been the same height as his nemesis, with those bearish shoulders, that barrel chest, the same filthy mane of hair and tangled beard. The long black raincoat had spread around him like a robe, and he'd had that leonine self-possession as if he were some mad prophet mystically transported from the days of the Old Testament and dropped into modern times. Harry braked at the end of the hallway by sliding into the intersection, wincing as hot coffee slopped out of the cup and stung his hand. He looked right, where the vagrant had been headed. The only people in that corridor were Bob Wong and Louis Yancey, loanouts from the Orange County Sheriff's Department who were consulting over a manila file folder. Harry said, "Where'd he go?" They blinked at him, and Bob Wong said, "Who?" "The hairball in the black raincoat, the hobo." The two men were puzzled. Yancey said, "Hobo? Well, if you didn't see him, you had to smell him."
"Just now?"
Wong asked.
"Yeah, 2 seconds ago."
"Nobody came through here," Yancey said.
Harry knew they weren't lying to him, weren't part of some immense conspiracy. Nevertheless, he wanted to walk past them and inspect all of the rooms along the corridor. He restrained himself only because they were already staring at him curiously. He suspected he was something of a sight. Disheveled, pale, wild-eyed. He could not tolerate the idea that he was making a spectacle of himself. He'd built a life on the principles of moderation, orderliness, and self-control. Reluctantly, he returned to his office. He took a cork coaster from his top desk drawer, put it on the blotter, and set the dripping cup of coffee on it. He kept a roll of paper towels and a spray bottle of Windex in the bottom drawer of one of the filing cabinets. He used a couple of the towels to blot his coffee-damp hands, then wiped off the wet cup. He was pleased to see that his hands were not shaky. Whatever the hell was happening, he would eventually figure it out and deal with it. He could deal with anything. Always had, always would. Self-control, that was the key. He took several slow, deep breaths. With both hands, he smoothed his hair back from his forehead. Heavy as a slab of slate, the lowering sky had pressed twilight into an earlier appearance. It was only a few minutes after 5 o'clock, an hour until sunset, but the day had surrendered to a protracted darkness. Harry turned on the overhead fluorescent lights. For a minute or two, he stood at the partially fogged window, watching tons of rain crash straight down on the parking lot. The thunder and lightning were long past, and the air was too heavy to permit wind, so the deluge had a tropical intensity, a grueling relentlessness that led the mind to ancient myths involving divine punishment, arcs, and lost continents vanished beneath swollen seas. Calmed somewhat, he returned to his desk chair and swung around to the computer. He was about to call up the case narrative document that he had saved before going down the hall for coffee, when he realized that the screen was not blank, as it would have been. Another document had been created in his absence. It consisted of a single word centered on the screen. Tick, tock. It was nearly 6 o'clock when Connie Gulliver returned to the office from the crime scene, having caught a ride in a Laguna Beach Police Department black and white. She was grousing about the media, one television reporter in particular who had dubbed her and Harry Batwoman and Batman for God alone knew what reason, maybe because their desperate pursuit of James Ordegard involved so much derring do, or maybe just because there had been a flock of bats in the attic where they had nailed the bastard. Electronic journalists did not always have discernibly logical reasons or credible justifications for doing and saying some of the things they did and said. Reporting the news was neither a sacred trust nor a public service to them. It was show business, where you needed flash and splash more than facts and figures. Connie had been around long enough to know all of that and to be resigned to it, but she was hot about it anyway, haranguing Harry from the moment she walked through the door. He was just finishing the paperwork when she arrived, having dawdled during the past half an hour waiting for her. He'd decided to tell her about the tramp and the blood-red eyes, in part because she was his partner, and he was loath to conceal anything significant from a partner. He and Ricky Estefan had always shared everything, which was one reason he had gone to see Ricky before returning to special projects, the other reason being that he valued Ricky's insights and advice. Whether the threatening hobo was real or a symptom of mental collapse, Connie had a right to know about him. If that filthy spectral figure was imaginary, perhaps just talking about him with someone would puncture the balloon of delusion. The hobo might never appear again. Harry also wanted to tell her because telling her gave him a reason to spend some off-duty time with her. At least a little socializing between partners was advisable, helped strengthen that special bond between cops who had put their lives on the line for each other. They needed to talk about what they had been through that afternoon, relive it together, and thereby transform it from a traumatic experience into a polished anecdote with which to annoy rookies for years to come. And in truth, he wanted to spend some time with Connie because he had begun to be interested in her not only as a partner, but as a woman, which surprised him. They were such opposites. He had spent so much time telling himself that she drove him nuts. Now he couldn't stop thinking about her eyes, the luster of her hair, the fullness of her mouth. Though he had not wanted to admit it, this change in his attitude had been building up speed for some time, and today gears had finally shifted in his head. No mystery about that. He'd nearly been killed. More than once. A brush with death was a great clarifier of thoughts and feelings. He'd not only had a brush with death, he'd been embraced by it, hugged tight. He had seldom harbored so many intense emotions all at once. Loneliness, fear, aching self-doubt, joy at just being alive, desire so acute that it weighed upon his heart and made breathing just a little more difficult than usual. "Where do I sign?" Connie asked when he told her he had completed the paperwork. He spread out all the requisite forms on his desk, including Connie's own official statement. He had written it for her as he always did, which was against department policy and one of the few rules he had ever broken. But they split the chores according to their skills and preferences, and he just happened to be better at this part than she was. Her own case narratives tended to be angry in tone instead of solemnly neutral, as if every crime was the most grievous personal affront to her, and sometimes she used words like asshole or shithead instead of suspect or arrestee, which was guaranteed to send the defendant's attorney into rapturous spasms of self-righteousness in the courtroom. Connie signed all of the forms that he put in front of her, including the cleanly typed statement attributed to her, without reading any of them. Harry liked that. She trusted him. As he watched her scribble her signature, he decided they should go somewhere special, even with him rumpled and damp. A cozy bar with plushly padded booths and low lighting and candles on the tables, a pianist making cocktail music, but not one of these slick guys who did polyester lounge versions of good tunes and sang Feelings once every half hour, the anthem of sentimental inebriates and mushheads in all 50 states. Connie couldn't stop fuming about being labeled Batwoman and other abuses suffered at the hands of the media, so Harry had difficulty finding a moment to insert an invitation to drinks and dinner, which gave him too much time to look at her. Not that she looked any less appealing the longer he watched her. Just the opposite. When he took the time to study her face, feature by feature, she proved to be more attractive than he had ever realized. The problem was, he also began to see just how tired she was. Red-eyed, pale, large, dark smudges of weariness beneath her eyes, shoulders slumped under the weight of the day. He began to doubt that she would want to have a drink and rehash the events of the lunch hour. And the more aware he became of her exhaustion, the more profoundly weary he felt himself. Her bitterness over the electronic news media's tendency to turn tragedy into entertainment reminded Harry that she had begun the day angry as well, troubled by something she had refused to discuss. As his ardor cooled, he wondered whether it was really such a good idea to have a romantic interest in a partner in the first place. Department policy was to split up teams who developed more than a friendly relationship when off duty, whether gay or straight. Long-enforced policies were usually based on a wealth of hard experience. Connie finished signing the papers and gave him a once-over. This is the first time you've ever looked as if you might consider shopping at the Gap instead of exclusively at Brooks Brothers. Then she actually hugged him, which might have stirred his passion again, except that it was a buddy hug. How's your gut feel?
Just a dull ache, that's all, thank you. Nothing that would inhibit me from making passionate, hot, sweaty love to you.
He said, I'm fine.
You sure?
Yeah.
God, I'm tired, said Connie.
Me too.
I think I'll sleep 100 hours, said Connie.
At least 10, Harry replied.
She smiled and, to his surprise, affectionately pinched his cheek.
See you in the morning, Harry.
He watched her as she walked out of the office. She was still wearing scuffed Reeboks, blue jeans, a red and brown checkered blouse, and a brown corduroy jacket. And the outfit was worse for the wear of the past 10 hours. Yet he could not have found her more alluring if she had been shoehorned into a clinging, sequined gown with canyonesque décolletage. The room was dreary without her. The fluorescent light painted hard, cold edges on the furniture, on every leaf of every plant. Beyond the steamed window, the premature twilight was giving way to night, but the stormy day had been so somber that the phase of demarcation was excruciatingly subtle. Rain hammered on the anvil of darkness. Harry had come full circle from physical and mental exhaustion to thoughts of passion to exhaustion once more. It was almost like being an adolescent boy again. He shut down the computer, switched off the lights, closed the office door, and filed copies of the reports in the front office. Driving home in the depressingly leaden fall of rain, he hoped to God that he could sleep and that his sleep would be without dreams. When he woke refreshed in the morning, perhaps the answer to the mystery of the crimson-eyed hobo would be apparent. Halfway home, he almost switched on the radio, wanting music. Just before he touched the controls, he stayed his hand. He was afraid that instead of some top 40 number, he would hear the voice of the vagrant chanting, tick-tock, tick-tock. Jennifer must have dozed off. It was ordinary sleep, however, not the delirium of the fantasy worlds that so frequently offered her escape.
When she woke, she did not have to shake off clinging visions of emerald, diamond, sapphire temples, or cheering audiences enthralled with her vocal virtuosity in a Carnegie Hall of the mind. She was sticky because of the humidity, with a sour taste in her mouth, stale orange juice, and heavy sleep. Rain was still falling. It drummed complicated rhythms on the roof of the hospital. Private sanitarium, actually. But not the rhythms alone. Chuckling, gurgling, burbling atonal melodies as well. Sightless, Jennifer had no easy way to know with certainty the hour of the day or the season. However, blind for 20 years, she had developed a refined awareness of her circadian rhythms and was able to guess the time of year and day with surprising accuracy. She knew that spring was drawing near. Perhaps it was March, the end of the rainy season in Southern California. She knew not the day of the week, but she suspected it was early evening, between 6 and 8 o'clock. Perhaps she had eaten dinner, though she did not remember it. Sometimes she was barely conscious enough to swallow when they spoon-fed her, but not sufficiently aware to enjoy what she ate. On other occasions, when in a deeper catatonic state, she received nutrients intravenously. Although the room was cast in silence, she was aware of another presence, either because of some indefinable peculiarity of the air pressure or an odor only subconsciously perceived. She remained motionless, trying to breathe as if sound asleep, waiting for the unknown person to move or cough or sigh and thereby provide her with a clue to identity. Her companion did not oblige her. Gradually, Jennifer came to suspect that she was alone with him. She knew that a pretense of sleep was safest. She struggled to stay perfectly still. Finally, she could no longer tolerate continued ignorance. She said,
"Margaret?"
No one responded. She knew the silence was false. She strove to recall the name of the swing shift nurse.
"Angelina?"
No reply. Only the rain. He was torturing her. It was psychological torture, but that was by far the most effective weapon that could be used against her. She had known so much physical and emotional pain that she had developed defenses against those forms of abuse.
"Who's there?"
she demanded. "It's me," he said. "Brian. Her Brian." His voice was soft and gentle, even musical, in no way threatening. Yet it caused ice to form in her blood. She said,
"Where's the nurse?"
"I asked her to leave us alone."
"What do you want?"
"Just to be with you."
"Why?"
"Because I love you." He sounded sincere, but she knew that he was not. He was congenitally incapable of sincerity.
"Go away," she pleaded.
"Why do you hurt me?"
"I know what you are."
"What am I?" She did not respond. He said, "How can you know what I am?"
"Who better to know?"
she said harshly, consumed by bitterness, self-loathing, loathing, and despair. Judging by the sound of his voice, he was standing near the window, closer to the plink and paradiddle of the rain than to the faint noises in the corridor. She was terrified that he would come to the bed, take her hand, touch her cheek or brow. She said,
"I want Angelina."
"Not yet."
"Please."
"No."
"Then go away."
"Why do you hurt me?" he asked again. His voice remained as gentle as ever, melodic as that of a choir boy, untouched by anger or frustration, only sorrow. "I come twice a week. I sit with you. Without you, what would I be? Nothing. I'm aware of that." Jennifer bit her lip and did not reply. Suddenly, she sensed that he was moving. She could hear no footsteps, no rustle of garments. He could be quieter than a cat when he wished to be. She knew he was approaching the bed. Desperately, she sought the oblivion of her delusions, either the bright fantasies or dark terrors within her damaged mind. She cared not which. Anything other than the horror of reality in that too private sanitarium room. But she could not retreat at will into those interior realms. Periodic involuntary consciousness was, perhaps, the greatest curse of her pathetic, debilitated condition. She waited, trembling. She listened. He was ghost silent. The thunderous pummeling of rain on the roof was cut off from one second to the next, but she understood that the rain had not actually ceased to fall. Abruptly, the world was clutched in the grip of an uncanny silence, stillness. Jennifer brimmed with fear, even into the paralyzed extremities of her left side. He took hold of her right hand. She gasped and tried to pull away.
"No,"
he said, and tightened his grip. He was strong. She called for the nurse, knowing it was useless to do so. He held her with one hand and caressed her fingers with the other. He tenderly massaged her wrist. He stroked the withered flesh of her forearm. Blindly, she waited, trying not to speculate upon what cruelties would ensue. He pinched her arm, and a wordless plea for mercy escaped her. He pinched harder, then again, but probably not hard enough to leave a bruise. Enduring, Jennifer wondered what his face was like, whether ugly or plain or handsome. She intuited that it would not be a blessing to recover her sight if she were required just once to gaze into his hateful eyes. He pushed one finger into her ear, and his nail seemed as long and pointed as a needle. He twisted it and scraped, pressed harder still until the pressure pain was unbearable. She screamed, but no one responded. He touched her pancake breasts, deflated from long years of supine existence and intravenous nourishment. Even in her sexless condition, her nipples were a source of pain, and he knew how to deliver agony. However, it was not so much anything he did to her that mattered, but what he might think to do to her next. He was endlessly inventive. True terror lay in the anticipation of the unknown. She screamed for someone, anyone, help, surcease. She begged God for death. Her shrieks and cries for help fell into a void. Finally, she was silent and endured. He released her, but she was acutely aware that he was still at her bedside.
Love me?
Brian said.
Please go away.
Softly.
Love me.
If Jennifer had been capable of producing tears, she would have wept.
Love me, and I won't have any reason to hurt you again. All I want is for you to love me.
She was no more capable of loving him than she was of producing tears from her ruined eyes. Easier to love a viper, a rock, or the cold, indifferent blackness between the stars.
I only need to be loved, he insisted.
She knew that he was incapable of love. Indeed, he had no concept whatsoever of the meaning of the word. He wanted it only because he could not have it, could not feel it, because it was a mystery to him, a great unknown. Even if she were able to love him and convince him of her love, she would not be saved, for he would be unmoved by love when at last it was given to him, would deny its existence, and would continue to torture her out of habit. Suddenly the rain sound resumed. Voices in the corridor. Squeaking wheels on the tiered cart that carried dinner trays. The torment was over. For now.
I can't stay long this evening, Brian said. Not the usual eternity.
He chuckled at that remark, amused by himself, but to Jennifer it was only an offensive wet sound in his throat, humorless. He said,
I've had an unexpected increase in business. So much to do, I'm afraid I've got to run.
As always, he marked his departure by bending over the bed railing and kissing the numb left side of her face. She could not feel the pressure or texture of his lips against her cheek, only a butterfly wing touch of coolness. She suspected that his kiss might have felt no different, maybe only colder, if planted on the still sensitive right side of her face. When he left, he chose to make noise, and she listened to his receding footsteps. After a while, Angelina came to feed her dinner. Soft foods, mashed potatoes with gravy, pureed beef, pureed peas, applesauce with a sprinkling of cinnamon and brown sugar, ice cream, things she would have no difficulty swallowing. Jennifer said nothing about what had been done to her. From grim experience, she had learned that she would not be believed. He must have the appearance of an angel, because everyone but her seemed disposed to trust him on first sight, attributing to him only the kindest motives and noblest intentions. She wondered if her ordeal would ever end. Riccia Stefan emptied half the box of rigatoni into the big pot of boiling water. A head of foam rose instantaneously, and an appealing starchy smell wafted up in a cloud of steam. On another burner stood a smaller pot of fragrantly bubbling spaghetti sauce. As he adjusted the gas flames, he heard a strange noise toward the front of the house. A thump, not especially loud, but solid. He cocked his head, listened. Just when he thought that he'd imagined the noise, it came again. Thump. He went down the hall to the front door, switched on the porch light, and looked through the fisheye lens in the peephole. As far as he could see, no one was out there. He unlocked the door, opened it, and cautiously leaned outside to look both ways. None of the outdoor furniture had fallen over. The night was windless, so the bench swing hung motionless on its chains. The rain continued to fall hard. In the street, the vaguely purplish light of the mercury vapor lamps revealed rivers along both gutters, nearly to the tops of the curbs, churning toward the drains at the end of the block, glistening like streams of molten silver. He was concerned that the thump had signaled storm damage of some kind, but that seemed unlikely without a good wind. After he closed the door, he twisted the deadbolt into place and slid the security chain home. Since being gut-shot and struggling back from the brink, he had developed a healthy paranoia. Well, healthy or unhealthy, it was a damned fine example of paranoia, shiny from use. He kept the doors locked at all times, and, with nightfall, he drew the drapes shut at every window so no one could peer inside. His fear embarrassed him. He had once been so strong, capable, and self-confident. When Harry had left earlier, Ricky had pretended to stay at the kitchen table working on the belt buckle. But as soon as he heard the front door close, he shuffled down the hall to slip the deadbolt quietly into place while his old friend was still on the front porch. His face had been burning with shame, but he'd been uneasy about leaving a door unlocked, even for a few minutes. Now, as he turned away from the door, the mysterious noise came again. Thump. This time he thought it was located in the living room. He stepped through the archway to find the source. Two table lamps were on in the living room. A warm amber glow suffused that cozy place. The coved ceiling was patterned with twin circles of light broken by the shadows of lampshade wires and finials. Ricky liked light throughout the house in the evening until he went to bed. He no longer was comfortable entering a dark room and then flicking a switch. Everything was in order. He even peered behind the sofa to be sure. Well, to be sure that nothing was amiss back there. Thump. His bedroom? A door in the living room opened on a small vestibule with a simply but charmingly coffered ceiling. Three other doors ringed the vestibule, guest bath, a cramped guest bedroom, and a master bedroom of modest dimensions, one lamp aglow in each. Ricky checked everywhere, closets too, but found nothing that could have caused the thumping. He pulled the drapes aside at each window to see if the latches were engaged and all the panes of glass intact. They were. Thump. This time it seemed to come from the garage. From the nightstand beside his bed, he got a revolver. Smith & Wesson 38 Chief Special. He knew it was fully loaded. He flipped the cylinder out and checked anyway. All five rounds were there. Thump. He developed a stitch in his lower left abdomen, a painful, stretching, twitching sensation with which he was too familiar, and although the bungalow was small, he needed more than a minute to reach the connecting door to the garage. It was off the hallway just before the kitchen. He leaned against it, one ear to the crack of the jamb, listening. Thump. The sound had definitely come from the garage. He pinched the deadbolt turn between thumb and forefinger, then hesitated. He didn't want to go into the garage. He became aware of a dew of perspiration on his brow. Come on, he said, but he didn't respond to his own urging.